Welcome, everyone, to the Take Control of Your Health podcast. This is Dr. Mercola bringing you the latest cutting-edge interviews to help you achieve optimal health. You can receive more information by subscribing to my free daily newsletter at mercola.com. Thank you so much for listening. So let's get started with this week's latest program to help you and your family take control of your health. Welcome, everyone. Dr. Mercola helping you take control of your health. And today we're going to talk about exogenous ketones. In other words, ketones that your body doesn't make and is made by something you take externally to. And we're going to be discussing that with Frank, who actually has a conflict of interest because he is a head of a company that makes these ketones. But I decided to bring him in because I think there is great value. I've changed my position quite a bit before Frank come on. I just want to clarify it. I now believe that it is relatively unhealthy for your body to create ketones. Not that you can't do it or shouldn't do it, but it's an emergency mechanism. There's great value to it. It keeps you alive. But in order to make ketones, you have to activate stress hormones. There's no other way you're going to do it. It's an emergency response. You're going to activate cortisol, adrenaline, glucagon. And if you do that chronically, I don't think it's a good idea. I used to do that, but I don't do it anymore. But that doesn't mean that ketones are dangerous. They're actually very powerful tools that you can use selectively to improve your health. And we're going to talk about how that does that in a bit. But, you know, if you choose to activate your ketones, you can. But just know that there's a counterpart that's rarely ever discussed, which is the activation of the stress hormones. And I'm convinced is a concern to do chronically. If you do it acutely, no problem. If you do it several times, a few times a month, probably fine. But if you do it every day, I think you're asking for trouble. That's my conclusion. You can certainly reach your own. So with all that preface and warning, appropriate warning for endogenous ketones, you have an exogenous ketone company. So welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, you actually worked with the very prominent ketone expert, Dr. Richard Veach, who passed away a few years ago now. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah, he was my wife's godfather. That's how I got introduced to all this and went down the rabbit hole.
So why don't you start the story by telling us a little bit about Dr. Veach? I fortunately never interviewed him. By the time I got around to it, he had already passed. I think David Asprey was the last person to interview, if I'm not mistaken. So tell us a little bit about Dr. Veach, because you, since you're an indirect relative of his, you know his history very well, and actually are essentially a business partner.
Sure.
Let us know the story.
Okay, so the story actually started a few months before I even knew what Dr. Veach was doing, when I saw a friend of mine. We were about to go clubbing, and he grabbed a pound of cheese, and he was overweight. He was well overweight, and he downed the entire pound of cheese. And I'm like, what in the world are you doing? He's like, I'm losing weight. I'm like, good luck with that, buddy. And obviously he was doing Atkins or ketogenic diet, and I knew nothing about that. Then I started hearing rumblings around the dinner table about this uncle who he should be given gold medals for how well the UK Olympic team did, because I then found out that his ketone ester was being given to the UK Olympic team, even though he's a US, you know, NIH scientist. So then I met him at a 80th, or I'm not sure what year, birthday party of my father-in-law. And I had already gone down the rabbit hole of endogenous ketones and what it is to be in a ketogenic state. And I was able to actually converse with him. And, you know, he wasn't used to conversing with someone, because for him to explain his life's work, like 35, 40 years with Hans Krebs, the Nobel laureate, you know, the Krebs cycle, trying to find a way to make try to recreate the endogenous ketone process through a drink. For him to have that conversation with someone at a dinner party, he just doesn't want to have it. He just doesn't want to be bothered. But we got along, and he was frustrated that he'd been sitting on this ketone ester for 10 years that hadn't come to market. And I tried to help him raise some funds, but here's how the pitch went. We think people will take $70 a day worth of a drink that tastes like vomit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, back then CBD was all the rage and stuff like that. So no one wanted to, you know, take a risk on something like this, even though Dr. Veach had all these papers. He just said, read the goddamn papers, but no one quite got it. And then he said, hey, why don't you go do it? And I said, okay.
So he wasn't a very effective marketer, but he delegated that responsibility to you.
He didn't believe in marketing or business. He just thought that someone should just give him $20 million and make a tanker cart of it and just have people walk up to the tanker cart with their little cups and just pour ketone ester and be done with it. He didn't understand, marketing. Yeah. And actually, I'm the one that brought him kicking and screaming to the Dave Asprey podcast because he didn't want to. He's like, why do I need to be on a podcast? Just read my papers. It's all in the papers. And I was like, well, the world has changed and people want to hear it. So then he very reluctantly even tried to cancel the date the morning of. And I made a cameo at the end because I was also experimenting with endogenous ketones. I could get up to 8 millimolars just endogenously without, any exogenous ketones.
And eight is pretty darn high. How the heck you weren't eating for a few weeks?
No. I just would get into a pattern of, not eating breakfast. And then after a while, I just wasn't hungry at lunch. So I'd be, only eating once a day. And then I would just, the meter was very friendly to me because sometimes it would read and say high. High means that it's above the 8 millimolar mark. So,
wow.
Yeah. But that's not even multi-day fasting, but just over a period of time, my body was able to switch to that.
Most people don't do that. I mean, they're lucky if they get to beyond 2 or maybe in 3. But you got
the biggest jump that I had was I was only hitting 1.5, 2. But then one day, accidentally, I missed lunch and then I missed dinner because I had to vote. And then I tested myself late. And that was the first time that I'd done an extra 6 or 7 hours. And that's when I jumped from the 1.5 to the 3.5. And I was like, oh, even eating fat doesn't kick you out of ketosis, but lowers your ketone numbers. Mm-hmm. So the key was not eating. And if I just didn't have an appetite, I just, wasn't eating. But I did lose too much weight. And then people had said, oh, it looked like I was, sickly and stuff like that. I felt great, but I was, I was underweight. So it was not sustainable at those super crazy high numbers. Yeah.
Do you know why you feel great? Or do you know why you felt great? Put it that way.
Well, ketones going to the brain, lower inflammation, inflammation and a different and better brain fuel.
Okay. So I guess what maybe you can... I don't know that it's better. It's better from some perspectives, and some others it's not, because the brain cannot function on ketones alone. That's biologically impossible. It will crash. You have to have glucose.
Well, didn't they test it? I thought there was a paper in the 70s from Harvard with Cahill where they were able to starve people for 30, 60 days, an experiment that they couldn't do nowadays. And Dr. Beach always laughs and says, well, they were theologians, so it was fine. But
I'd like to see that paper. To the best of my knowledge, that's not true. I could be mistaken.
Yeah, it was long periods, 30, 60 days that they were able to convert and be just running on ketones. Okay. And I've been keto myself.
Wait. I know why that's not true, okay? With respect to they were fasting, they had no sources of exogenous glucose. Right. None.
No food, period. Complete 30, 60 day fast, like a Jesus fast.
But I'll tell you why they still had glucose in the brain. Do you know why?
Well, the body makes it.
Yeah.
Breaks
it
down. Yeah.
It was gluconeogenesis, which is why.
So in that instance, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I'm taking you. I didn't. So let me clarify my statement. My statement is that your body absolutely requires glucose, but not to eat, because it requires it so much that if you fail to eat the glucose, it will sacrifice your body to create it.
Right. So gluconeogenesis, breaking down the muscle to get it some way. Yeah, I agree with that.
Adrenaline, glucagon, and cortisol, all of which activate the destruction of primarily your lean muscle mass and your bones and even some brain tissue to sacrifice that tissue to create glucose. Sends it to the liver. Liver converts it to glucose and sends it back to the brain. So you have to have it. If your glucose in your blood goes down to zero, you're dead very shortly.
I could agree with that. I mean, I don't know the nuances of that, but that sounds reasonable. Your body makes the trickle amount to keep it going.
And one of the ways you commit suicide is just inject a lot of insulin. The insulin will drop your blood sugar low enough below the threshold, and you'll go into a coma and die. So that's just illustrates the vast importance. Yes, ketone is a great fuel. As you mentioned, it does a lot of good things, but you still need glucose. And if you want to augment it, I think that really the almost ideal is to give your body the glucose and then still give it some ketones. But the only way you can do it without your product or a product similar to yours is to fast. And then you activate those stress hormones again. So when you take
if you want to get the super high numbers, there are people that are able to maintain a 0.5, 1.0 and just live life in a low carb diet and get a steady trickle of ketones. But yeah, if you want to get super high ketones, you got to do a multi-day fast, and that's only going to last so long.
Yeah, yeah. As you know, and I think the comments that you were getting on the way you looked, there's probably some accuracy. You look sickly. So people aren't stupid, and they're not mean and trying to disparage you needlessly. They were concerned because you didn't look healthy.
Yeah.
You know, that can be easily discerned by most people. So there's probably some intuitive concern there.
There's also a facial color that some people even.
Yeah.
So not only the extra too slender, but also some facial color. So that was just an experiment. And you know, I had my wife try to go keto for a little bit, and she got the keto flu, and she was in a fetal position in bed with her eyes bulging, heart racing, be like, what have you done to me? Like these damn experiments. And for her, I called some experts and they said, give her 10 capsules of just salt. And I was like, what? You're going to like overdose on salt? They're like, no, you can't. Well, I don't know if you can't, but you won't overdose on salt. And within 10 minutes, she was fine. Like it was just a salt depletion. I've even heard about people going to the hospital because they tried to do a ketogenic diet. And they said 2 hours sitting in the weight room, they couldn't figure out what it was. And I said, I can tell you what it was. They said two Harvard doctors couldn't tell me what it was for the first 2 hours. How do you know what it was? I said, I bet you they just gave you salt and you were fine. She's like, how did you know that? It's like, you didn't tell them that you did a ketogenic diet. So they're looking for all these different things. And it was just salt depletion. And people say, oh, the ketogenic diet doesn't work for me. Well, did you get enough salt? And they go, yeah, I put extra salt to my eggs. I said, did you unscrew the salt container and add salt to your eggs? Because the massive amount of salt loss on keto, people just, they just can't fathom it. They need huge, huge salt loads.
Yeah, that's certainly true. You want to make sure you have enough salt. Otherwise, you're going to run into problems. So there's a number of different options, and you can run us through the chronology because you were involved in all of them and actually have implemented some new strategies in providing ketones, which I want to talk about. The traditional ones were these ketone esters, and then there's a lot of different derivatives of the ketone esters. And
sure, I can go through the whole umbrella.
Yeah, I want you
world of exogenous ketone and walk all the way through it.
Yeah, that's what I want you to do, because there's a lot of confusions about the enantiomers or the stereoisomers or which ones. And Dr. Veach had some really strong opinions. I suspect you share his views. Is that correct?
Yeah. He would. He would come back from the grave and slap me if I did anything.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's diametrically opposed to another expert in the field who disagreed with Dr. Veach, and that's Dr. Dominic D'Agostino, who believes there's alternative strategies. And I don't really know enough about the science to place a vote here, but I'd be interested in your perspective as one view to look at.
All right. So the umbrella category of exogenous ketones means drinking something that will raise your blood ketones. So there are, you know, 7 or 8 products that we can go through right now. The first one, people often don't even put into this category, which is MCT C8 oil. Mm-hmm. I kind of call it a half endogenous, half exogenous ketone because it's a fat. So it works towards your macros, but 10 to 15% of it goes to the liver and creates D-beta hydroxybutyrate, creates ketones. So you can eat a cake and add C8 to it and your ketones will go up. Now, it doesn't mean you're in ketosis as a regular consumer would define ketosis, which is, you know, the consumer thinks of it as burning fat to make ketones. You wouldn't be doing that. You would be exogenously consuming this oil on your cake.
But you're still getting the benefits.
We're getting some of the benefits. I think the cake would negate next to all the benefits, but you are getting some ketones in your system.
Well, it depends on what the cake was made from. If it was made of conventional.
I'm just talking about regular oils
in it, then of course it's going to be dangerous. And, you know, refined sugar, especially with high fructose corn syrup, is never a good idea.
So I'm sure you could
make a healthy cake.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You can make a healthy cake for sure. That exists. Just you can make a healthy pizza. It's difficult to do, but you can do it.
Yeah. I'm just talking about grocery store cake.
Oh, that's
you can add, you can add C8, you can add C8 to it and it'll raise your ketones. And technically, you know, some would say, oh, look, I'm burning fat, but you're not.
No, you're not burning fat, but you are still getting the benefit of exogenous ketone elevation.
And, you would be getting some of the ketones in there.
Why don't we go over that now? Because I think it's important to understand that, because there is benefit, anti-inflammatory benefit primarily. Yep. HJAK inhibitors, which is an anti-inflammatory component, which is really important. So why don't you review some of the benefits independent of the food that you're eating?
Well, anti-inflammatory, and some people, for cognition, the more of an issue you have with glucose reaching the brain, the more of a benefit you have. So some people will drink it, whether it's any of these exogenous ketones, and feel nothing in the brain. But if your brain is being fueled by 100% or 95%, there is no improvement to be had. Steve Kunane, Steve Kunane talked about the brain energy gap. So the bigger the gap, the percentage of the brain that can be fueled by glucose, it could be 60, 70%. You add exogenous ketones, it uses a different pathway, reaches the brain, and gets you closer to that 100%. So some people, for example, TBI people, they have brain fog, they take the ketone ester, and it is instant, immediate, and predictable. Like within 15 minutes. It's not even like a 10-day, 30-day thing. It's just instant. So the bigger the gap, the more you feel it. But then there's...
And that gap that you're referring to is the lack of sufficient fuel to generate, to activate the cellular processes in the brain. Because the brain is only 2% of the body weight, but yet consumes 20% of the body's energy. It's a big energy producer, one of the biggest.
So some people just, they're not able to... The glucose isn't able to fully fuel their brain. So there's that gap. And then this helps fill that gap.
Okay.
So within the exogenous ketones, you've got the C8. And then you've got what first came to market, which is called the racemic ketone salts. And what that is, Dr. Veach had this 20 years ago, and he threw it in the trash. It's beta hydroxybutyrate. We'll talk about chirality in a second, but it's beta hydroxybutyrate added to, which is an acid, which you can't really drink directly by itself because the pH is too low. It would burn a hole in your gut, bound to a base. So sodium, magnesium, calcium, potassium. And those are called ketone salts. They used to be 100 different brands on Amazon, all making all these claims that it was just ridiculous. And one problem was that the salt load was just way too high. So 2-4 grams. I'm all for salt. I just finished saying unscrew the top of your, shaker to put more salt in, especially when you're entering into keto. But these ketone salts were just way too high and salt load. Now, some people would use them, the ketone salts, because they would raise your ketones barely. So you'd have an entire serving of ketone salts and maybe be lucky if you get a 0.3 rise in your millimolars. And if you took the capsules of racemic salts, maybe if you took half of the bottle, you might be able to get 15 out of the 30 capsules, you might be able to have a 0.2, 0.3 rise, just next to none, raise in blood ketone levels. So those are racemic salts. The word racemic means that, some products like D-ribose or L-tryptophan, the L form is what the body can use. Sometimes it's the D form. And with salts, with ketones, it's the D form, D-beta hydroxybutyrate. But these first products were the racemic form, which means the D form, and the L form, which the body can't use. We can discuss it that, some scientists say that because the body can't use it as an energy source and can't get rid of it, that it stays in the system and might have some other effects, such as reducing, hunger. But Dr. Veach was adamant about only using the D form, only using the form that your body recognizes and uses, and not to use any foreign substances, in part because of unintended consequences. There have been, some medicines that were accidentally racemic when they should have been chiral. And then after 8 million doses, they say, we just discovered, the problem that occurred from having the racemic. So it doesn't mean that everything racemic is bad. Advil, which you probably would put in the bad category, Advil is racemic, but it's not bad because it's racemic. It just happens to be racemic. So the racemic ketone salts first on the market, and a lot of promotion and touting and weight loss promotion. The funny thing is, some people would actually find benefit in using these when they first entered into a ketogenic diet. And then they would say, oh, wow, this really helped me get through the brain fog or the keto flu. And I said, well, did you try just using the salt? It's just the salt portion, because I think that the benefit that people were feeling with the racemic ketone salts were A, caffeine. So most of the drinks, they load in caffeine. So you quote unquote feel something. So that's not ketones. But then the massive salt load was helping them with the keto flu. But they could have just saved a whole bunch of money by using, you know, pink Himalayan sea salt and saved money. And I did get reports of people saying after 1 or 2 weeks entering into keto, I'd still be taking these racemic ketone salts and I couldn't put my ring finger on. Why? Because after you're transitioned into the ketogenic diet, you no longer need that massive, massive salt load. And that salt load is because you lose 2, 3, 4, 5 pounds of weight. But that weight is all water within the first few days. And that water just has grams and grams and grams of salt. So you need that, you know, replenishment. So people were claiming that after 2 weeks, it wasn't working. So then they put the can up on the shelf and then wait for, you know, 5 months later when they want to do the ketogenic diet again, and they pull it down. And I said, great, but save some money, go get some just salt. And then finally, the chiral version of the salts came out, which is much more expensive to do. And you'll know whether a product is the D-form or not, because they're going to brag about it on their labeling, because it costs so much more. No one's going to accidentally use the higher purity without saying, you know, D, also known as R, which is kind of confusing. But D, beta hydroxybutyrate ketone salts. So those are the ketone salts. But even Dr. Veach, even the R form, was not a fan of those because the salt load was still way too high, except for maybe during that transition time. And then you have the ketone ester, which now has its own umbrella of several different ketone esters. It used to be that there was only one ketone ester. So all the scientific papers were very easy to understand. Ketone ester meant this molecule, which I'll discuss, which is D beta hydroxybutyrate, the free acid form, bound to R13-butanediol, also known as D13-butanediol. And what happened was the ester enters into the bloodstream intact. People thought it actually separated in the gut. And if it separates in the gut, why not just take the two parts separately? But drug companies will make an ester form of something to enter into the bloodstream more readily. So they did find that the ketone ester got into the bloodstream. Then enzymes would separate it, making it into a fast release of D-beta hydroxybutyrate, free acid, the same molecule that your body makes when it burns fat. And then R13-butanediol that goes through the liver, and 80% of that converts to ketones. So you have a fast release and a slow release. So then the next exogenous ketone, and I'll come back to the other ketone esters.
Now, is the ketone ester the one that Dr. Veach uses?
Yeah, so Dr. Veach is a ketone ester, which we now more specifically call ketone monoester. Mono means one bond, because Dom has a ketone ester, technically ketone ester, but it's the word ester just means a bond of two ingredients where one of them is ketogenic, only one. So actually 10 years ago, they used to call ketone salts ketone esters, actually, yeah. Because it's a bond. But they stopped doing that, used the name ketone salts, thank God. But Dom has the acetoacetate, which is a different ketone, which is less energetic than the beta-hydroxybutyrate, bound to racemic 1,3-butanediol, but that is not a ketone monoester, but still in the category of ketone ester. There's two other esters that are out there now. One is a C6 or C8. They've made two different versions because the first one didn't work. Bound to R13-butanediol. So they actually take that C8 and make an ester of it, but that molecule is actually too large and it doesn't enter into the bloodstream intact. So it's, I don't know how different that is than just taking the two separately, but they make an ester of it. I think in part to be proprietary, but it's 16% as bioavailable. So they'll market this $5 drink and say $25 of ketones, you know, cost less per gram, but it's just not bioavailable. Has to be taken with food, which kind of defeats 90% of the use cases of how we give the ketone ester. So that makes it even less effective than the 16%. And then there's another one that's D-beta hydroxybutyrate bound to glycerol, but two or three glycerol molecules. Again, not a monoester. So that's why we're starting to put on our bottle ketone monoester. So to distinguish, because these companies say, look, we sell ketone ester and all the papers talk about ketone ester. And I call that science hijacking. It's like, it's a different molecule. Don't be confused. It looks cheaper, but it's actually, I think, I consider it more expensive because you need so much more of it to work. And the glycerol ester, the glycerol converts into glucose. So we'll have to do, time will tell with trials, whether that's beneficial for certain instances, which it might be. And the one that with the C8, one benefit that I can give to them is that it actually works better with food than the ketone monoester. Ketone monoester with food just doesn't penetrate. So if someone for some reason had to take something with food to limit glucose spikes, maybe that drink would be better, you know, for that instance. But for a fasted workout or for workout period, because of the GI issues of that molecule, you know, I don't think any athlete's going to do that. So then the last molecule in this umbrella of exogenous ketones is R13-butanediol. So this is half of the molecule of the ketone ester, so D-beta hydroxybutyrate, bound to R13. I asked Dr. Veach, hey, just making the R13-butanediol is much cheaper than that extra expense of making an enzymatic bond and all the loss and material and the extra processing and time and just money. Why not just give an extra, you know, 30-40% of the R13 to make up so that the blood levels would be the same as the ketone monoester? And his answer changed everything. He said the mice were stumbling, the mice were drunk. Because hypertechnically, 1,3-butanediol, the word diol means alcohol. It's a form of alcohol. Now, people think of alcohol and then it turns them off. They say, oh, I don't drink alcohol. No, you don't drink ethanol. So ethanol is what's in beer, vodka, wine. People think that they're drinking different alcohols. No. They're all drinking ethanol for the last 7,000 years. So this is technically a type of alcohol, but not ethanol. And so R13, yeah, it gets you buzzed. It got the mice buzzed. So he wanted to use it for therapeutic purposes, but you know, he can't have grandma stumbling around, you know, all day. So he threw that out. I took that out of the trash and said, I think some people might want that. And that's when I filed a patent for that. And then it took 4 years because I was making the ketone ester and we had supply problems. We had to scale it up and buy all the equipment. We manufacture it all. We ultimately then launched this separate company called Hard Ketones to just focus on the R13-butanediol as an alcohol alternative, you know, with GABA receptors, and it gets you buzzed. And we put in, I don't like to say that one is 3 times or 10 times stronger. It's just different. So we like to say different ketones, different results. So the ketone ester is better for brain sharpness, or it, you love to take it on that airplane or for sports performance. The hard ketones is more for a relaxation, you know, trigger some GABA responses and to get that buzz. And we put 17 grams of the R13 into, you know, one of these cans, 15 to 17 grams. Meanwhile, what we call one serving is 2.5 grams of ketone ester. So just a massive factor, you know, 8 times the quantity on a per serving basis. It's just drastically different. But some companies that try to market it as, oh, it's the new and improved, better than ketone ester because it's slow release, it's all hogwash.
Yeah. So why don't we review some of the benefits? You alluded to them earlier, when you might want to use this therapeutically. I'm not convinced that using it chronically is a good idea, or it's necessary, unless you're really exposed to some very severe oxidative stress. But I know through Dr. Veach's associate, would be the best to call him, Bill Curtis, who you well know, really sharp guy in molecular biology and understood a lot of Veach's work, helped me understand that one of the therapeutic applications of these, of raising ketones, was be a radical decrease in oxidative stress, really significantly. And it does it through the mechanism of activating NADPH, I believe.
Yep. Well, maybe that is something that Veach talked about with the other ketone molecules, was that people just want to look at BHB numbers and say, hey, if you get, doesn't matter the molecule, if you can get to 1 millimolar, it's all the same, but there's so many more things going on in the background. And he explains in a video that I got of him talking about how the NAD-NADPH ratio is not something that we can test easily in the blood. And just because your BHB levels are at 1 millimolar doesn't, you could be messing up the real thing that matters over here with the ratios. So that's why also he wasn't a fan of these other molecules, because of that ratio analysis.
Yeah. And sadly, there's not really any good existing tool to measure that. I mean, there, you can measure NADH directly or NAD plus directly, but that's almost impossible. There's probably only a few labs in the world can do that, and you can't send your blood to them because freezing the sample really doesn't work very well. Or you could, it could work, but it's such a perishable molecule. You almost have to do the lab in or the test in the lab that's doing it.
Well, I think it's going to be just real world experience of, you know, mental cognitive tests with both molecules. You know, what worked? What made you drunk? I mean, some people slur their words and bump into tables with the hard ketones. And other companies are saying, use this before your LSAT exams. I'm just like, it just blows my mind. It's just so confusing.
So but I'm just trying to understand the benefits for those who may be open to it.
So
back to oxidative stress. And let me give you examples. You're going to get a CT scan. You're getting chemotherapy. You're going on a flight and you're traveling at 35,000 feet, which is significantly higher than Mount Everest, folks. Like significantly, it's like another 10,000 feet. And it's pretty bad up there at Mount Everest. So it gets much worse higher you go. And that thin shield of aluminum you have wrapped around you at 35,000 feet doesn't stop gamma rays.
Yeah.
It comes right through like a hot knife through butter. And it's going to cause oxidative stress in your cells. No question. So when you increase, I think this is one of the good strategies for those types of instances, CT scans, extra x-rays, to do that. And maybe you can discuss some of the dosing on that, because from my perspective, I don't recall, but there's a bit of divergent opinion on it, whether you take it right before, after, or even wait a day and take it the day after, I think is what Leach was recommending. So maybe walk us through some of the different strategies.
Well, with radiation, there's going to be a paper coming out within a month. It's been 7 years in the making, and it was briefly touched upon in a chemistry book, which is why I can mention it, where they gave mice enough radiation so that 70% of the mice died. Mm-hmm. And then they took another group and gave them ketone ester either before and after or just after. And when they took it before and after, 100% of them survived and then, you know, lived just as long. And then if they were taken just afterward, 90% of them survived. So just massive, you know, just taking it afterward. So that is going to be, I think, a groundbreaking paper. It's going to open up so many possibilities. As far as for cancer, what we really need to understand.
Are you one of the authors on the paper?
No. I'm not a doctor, not a scientist. I just pushed them to get things published because Veach was screaming about getting that published 3 or 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, bureaucracy, it just wasn't coming out. So the prospects for that, for cancer, the next step for understanding the science there, and I wish someone has the money to donate to make this happen, is to make sure that the radiation only protects the good cells, that it doesn't accidentally protect the bad cells. And there's theories. So Travis Christofferson, who wrote the book, Ketones, the Fourth Fuel, great book to take a deep dive on this. He explained to me, but not in a way that I can re-explain, that the good cancer cells are protected and the bad cancer cells, you know, shouldn't be protected. So for potential cancer, you would want to make sure with some sort of study that it's only protecting the good cells and not accidentally protecting the bad cells, because that mice study just shows that it protects the entire body. It doesn't show the difference that you need. And a lot of cancer radiation, my understanding is, it's a fine balance between how much radiation you give to kill the cancer versus killing the host. You don't want to kill the person with too much radiation. So if you have an opportunity to be more aggressive on the radiation or, you know, protect from that has a lot of, you know, prospects.
So many people hear the word cancer and the first thing they do is run. And I do mean run straight to the chemotherapy or the oncologist, who almost universally recommends chemotherapy. Not all, but most do, I think. And the sad reality is that a large percentage, if not the majority of them, strong majority, actually benefit directly. They're financially reimbursed by that cancer, by that recommendation for the drug, which should be illegal, but it's not. I don't know why it isn't. And these drugs aren't cheap. I mean, they could easily be into six figures per month.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's a massive conflict of interest there. And now I'm not claiming that's true for all oncologists, and there's probably some where it's not at all. But it is a concern. It's a risk. And my experience with treating cancer, or helping people treat their cancers, I was never a primary clinician for doing that. It's something I avoided assiduously. So I didn't really understand the science of it. Now I understand the science of biology much better at a foundational level. And essential to that is optimizing your mitochondrial function. There's no question. That is the key. That is the core to improving health and removing diseases. So if you're going to engage in chemotherapy, I would first encourage you to consider not doing that. Not doing that. Because essentially what you're doing is sabotaging your ability to survive. You're essentially putting handcuffs on any physician who understands health to help you in the future. And in most cases, you're writing a premature death sentence. That's how strongly I feel about it. I just couldn't say it more clearly. Don't take chemo. Your life depends on it, to not take it. But if you first decide for whatever reason that I'm sure there are exceptions, and I'm sure the absolutes are rarely ever true, and I'm sure it's the case here. And in those exceptions, or for whatever reason, you decided to risk it, because what drives that decision mostly is fear. And fear, and because your life's at stake. It's literally life and death situation. It's a question. So if you're going to take that, I know this is a long prelude to it, but I really believe that you would be very foolish not to consider high doses of these ketones, because it will provide protection against the healthy cells from being damaged, specifically your immune cells. When you knock out your immune system, your ability to fight cancer almost disappears. So you have to be really, really careful. So given that context of the massive preventive potential in that scenario, what would you advise for dosages of someone considering chemo?
Oh, that's where I prefer to have the doctor give recommendations, but
there are ranges, you know.
Yeah. And so, you know, hitting I can tell you that there is a concept out there called therapeutic ketosis, where it's like 3 to 5, some random number on a chart, and I'm not sure that I completely agree with that. There have not been that's more mice data, and with the mice data, I'm not even sure that they compared 1 versus 2 versus 3 versus 4. They just like this phrase 3 to 5, and I get phone calls all the time saying, I can't hit 5 millimolars, and if I don't hit it, I'm going to... And I'm like, your stress is actually making everything worse than you're attaining these numbers. So we've seen plenty of benefits for cognition, even in 0.5, 1 millimolar, the tiniest amount. As far as with radiation, I don't know. I'd love for someone to fund a study that compares one number versus another number, but if you want to keep it simple, just, you know, $5 worth, just to, you know, get something.
Well, you know, if a life is at stake here, I think you'd want to be a little more precise than just wing it with $5 worth, you know. I mean, what do you think your opinion is helpful, and I wouldn't ask it if I didn't think it wasn't.
I just don't know. I don't know if one millimolar helps versus two millimolar.
I don't think the answer is in, although it's more accurate, is to measure your ketones and see what it is, because the dose can differ. But what do you think? If it was you, what would you take?
First of all, I load it up for 2 or 3 days beforehand. I think
What does that mean? What does that mean?
Would be 10 to 20 millimolars, so 2 to 4 servings every day. We used to call a serving the entire bottle. Now the cap became a serving, which is 5 mL. So we go to 20 mL.
That's the concentrate.
Yeah, the concentrate. The KE4, which is 50% ester.
You can't talk about the concentrate without a warning.
On the taste.
It's terrible.
It tastes really bad. Some people say that they like it, and I say, don't tell anyone else, because then they're going to manage expectations and they're going to think that it tastes good. No. It's like taking a shot of apple cider vinegar or a shot of ginger, if that's your mentality.
That would be good. This is not that.
You think it's okay? All
right. This was much worse than that. I'm allergic to it. I can't take it anymore. It's just so – and probably it's a clue that for me that isn't good. I would consider it if I was in an unusual scenario, because it is a powerful therapeutic agent. There's no question. And that's primarily the reason why I had you on, because I think people should know about it. I'm not necessarily suggesting or endorsing that people take it. That's for you to consider and evaluate yourself. But there are cases where I think it's very, very helpful, and potentially even life and death cases.
Well, we'll get you some of the raw stuff, which tastes even worse, because you might be having some reactions.
I don't want the raw stuff. Do not send me the raw stuff.
Because you might be, I mean, we have stevia in our main ketone ester, so maybe there's some reaction there. Because usually people do not have a reaction. That's very rare that someone.
This is severe nausea, and I typically don't have a problem with stevia. I don't mind stevia.
Yeah. I didn't want to talk about this, but I actually tried to. Maybe they did FedEx it to you. We are coming out with something new. that has 6 times more water, zero burn, just ketone ester.
I think they're packaging. Is it the hard ketones?
No. We call it ketone shots.
Ketone shots, okay.
So just straight up ketone ester in water. Doesn't even have stevia. It has just monk fruit, no burn. And it's the equivalent of 2 capfuls, but in a 2 ounce bottle, similar to this other product that we have called KE1, but it's just the ketone ester in water. And you'll like that. It's very smooth. But we think that will replace our own KE4, which is our 80-90% market share is KE4.
Wow. So that's a big transition for your company.
The plan is to finally make it taste good and just monk fruit, some inulin. And that will make a big difference.
It's a profoundly effective probiotic.
Yeah.
If you have healthy gut bacteria, if you don't, it could actually make you worse. Do you know how it makes you worse? It indiscriminately feeds your bacteria in your gut. And if you have a predominance of disease-causing bacteria, otherwise known as pathogenic bacteria, which is usually a facultative anaerobe that actually can survive with oxygen, because most of the bacteria in your large intestine should not be exposed to oxygen. And if they do get it, they're dead. But when you're unhealthy because of dietary choices, you change the environment. So if you have and most people have this, actually, this is why I'm discussing it, because if you have that scenario in your gut and you give them inulin, you can feed the bad bacteria, which in their cell walls, what makes them bad is they have something of a fat sugar combination called lipopolysaccharide, LPS for short. And when those bad bacteria die, that is something that is also called endotoxin. It is a severe toxin, really just as bad as omega-6 and estrogen. And it causes cellular damage. It can kill people actually in excess and cause septic shock. Really big problem. So anyway, but if you're healthy, that inulin is amazing because it feeds the good bacteria and really will help them grow.
We put in a very small amount as well, as few ingredients as possible, because we're focusing on the ketones, doing the work. But one comment about whether to take it for certain situations or over time. The plan was with Dr. Veach for it to be a daily elixir forever, like just another, kicking in another 0.5 ketones on a daily basis.
Okay, so that is an interesting comment, and I appreciate that. And Dr. Veach was a smart guy. He really was. And so unfortunately, he didn't have the skill set to communicate effectively to the masses. In fact, he was severely challenged, actually, which was probably one of the reasons why I didn't connect with him. Because there's a lot of people smarter than him that can communicate. He just chose to live in this state where he didn't want to communicate when people didn't understand him. And that was very few people. There was probably only a handful of people on the planet that could communicate with him effectively.
Agreed.
You have to be a molecular biologist to do that. And like almost a world-class molecular biologist.
One of his papers was about ketones for longevity in particular. And he looked at 4 or 5 different animal models where the animals lived longer under different trials. And each one of the papers had a different reason why they thought that the animal lived longer. Either it was, fasted or caloric deprivation. And his conclusion was, hey, you guys all missed it. It was because each one of these models triggered ketones, and it was the ketones that led to the animals living longer.
And that's his
high-level summary of that paper, which you can take into a different level.
And the basis for that observation was his assessment of the data that concluded that the common denominator was elevated ketones.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I would propose, and obviously they weren't taking exogenous ketones.
Right. That's just
endogenous. Which is interesting observation and really lends strong support to what I believe at this point is a supposition. And that is that there could be some huge benefit that you could achieve very similar results that those animals achieve without fasting. Because I'm not convinced, as I stated when I, opened up this discussion, is that endogenous ketones is likely more harm than good for most people. And I would not recommend that. But to take an exogenous ketone product like yours, it's a whole different story because you're not activating stress hormones at all. Yeah. None. Zero.
You'll like this. The actual, for clinical trials, when they come to me and ask what I recommend as far as the diet, because one thing is how much exogenous ketones to take. And the other thing is, well, what diet do we put them on? I think the ideal diet is a low glycemic index, non-ketogenic diet with exogenous ketones. Because I think half of the problem is the sugar. So when you're on a ketogenic diet, people love it, but we don't know how much of the benefit is the ketones and how much of the benefit is just getting rid of that sugar, the glycemic spikes and stuff like that. So the best of both worlds could be the low glycemic index, so things that don't spike your blood sugar. So I tell people, buy an $88 continuous glucose monitor before buying my ketone ester. Let's see what your blood glucose is doing spiking and try to hammer that down and flatten that before spending money on ketone ester. So the ideal diet, I think, is low glycemic, but not necessarily keto, and then adding exogenous ketones, especially in a short-term basis, because short-term basis, you're going to do it wrong. You're going to do the ketogenic diet wrong. You're going to get into the keto flu. You're going to be, you know, stressed out. So just lowering your carbs and getting rid of high glycemic foods is going to be half the battle, and then adding exogenous ketones to that. And when people tell me that they drink orange juice and then they want to take ketone ester for their cognition, I'm like, don't even bother. Like, it just...
Well, I would offer a different evaluation or recommendation, because I disagree pretty strongly with that. And you say, what? That would be my older version. The newer version is a deep appreciation of the importance of glucose as the primary fuel in the mitochondria. Now, to achieve that state is a challenge for most people because of the reference I made earlier that most people's microbiome is seriously dysfunctional as a result of the dietary choices they previously made. And when you have these gram negatives that have endotoxin in their cell walls and you take carbohydrates, specifically fruit, which I believe is the best food on the planet, and you, the polyphenols are particularly good, but it has fiber, and the fiber can go in and it can activate these pathogenic bacteria, and it can cause a lot of problems, complications. So you have to be really, really careful about optimizing your microbiome. And there's specific strategies that can be done that I'm not going to discuss in this podcast. But if your microbiome is healthy, and then you can eat fruit, and you can even eat starches. And it's shocking because I typically eat between 400 and 500 grams of carbs a day. And I know many people, I can think of Ashley Armstrong as one, who is 140 pounds and eats 600 grams of carbs a day, yet has totally normal blood sugars and normal glycohemoglobins because their mitochondria, our mitochondria, can burn glucose effectively. We have a very active metabolism, and that is no suppression in thyroid hormone. Our other hormones are fine, and you can burn that fuel. When you're burning that fuel, then that's, which is, I think, the crux of your argument, is you're concerned with the recommendation of low glycemic because that's the way most people are ostensibly achieving it. But I don't think it's ideal. I think it's far from ideal. Because if you have a low glycemic, you still run the risk of activating the stress hormones. If you take not enough carbs, you're going to activate adrenaline and cortisol, and those are not good chronically. They're great that they exist and they keep you alive. No question. Thank God we have them. Without them, we would be dead. Assuredly. But if you activate them all the time, you're going to run to trouble.
But what about the stress, if you don't mind, the stress of, you know, drinking an orange juice and having your blood sugar shoot up?
Well, that's not a stress. That's not stress.
That's not actually stress.
Like, unless you consider like a hormetic stress. Yes, will it spike? It'll spike, but it spikes and comes right back down. Right back down. If you're healthy. If you're not, you know, if you're metabolically unflexible or inflexible, then that's going to be an issue. So you need to control your insulin. So the other component of this is you need to be insulin sensitive.
Right.
You do a fasting insulin level and it's two or three, under three or under two or under two, which mine has been many times, under two, 1.5. Try to get an insulin level of 1.5 fasting. It's pretty low. So you have to be insulin sensitive. If your insulin is fasting is 5 or 10 or even higher, you got a problem, then you're not going to be able to do that. And then you will have an issue. So there's other, you know, the diet, the exercise, the sleep, there's a lot of variables that, and even emotional stressors can be a factor. But once you get that optimized, then, and you're looking at ideal biology, then I think orange juice, I drink about 4 ounces of orange juice every night before I go to bed.
Wow.
Yeah. For specifically to do that, to give that fuel. Because it's really easily digestible and you're not really activating digestive processes because it's very simple. Now, I would not eat protein or fat before I go to bed at all.
Funny thing is, people actually drink our ketone ester before bed. It's one of the top uses.
I think that's a good idea because I haven't done it for a while, but I was putting the ketone esters with the orange juice.
Really? Okay. That's well. That's
we play with it. I think you might see a difference, and I think there's good biological theory to support that, because I think what Avicii was onto something when he said that the ketone elevation is probably it, and it feels like that would be a good strategy, which is why I had you on the show, because I really think there's merit to what you're doing and providing, and you do a good job at providing it. And
what do you think about the hard ketones on that side of the alcohol alternative to help people
get it? You have more. This is your life job. I mean, you live, breathe, and eat this thing all day long. So your insights are going to be better than mine. I can reconcile some of the biology better than you, but you know the ketones, top to bottom. So that is my understanding, and correct me my misunderstanding. If that's the case, that there wouldn't be much of a difference as long as it's just a source of ketones and supplying that to your body.
It's pretty different. It's very different. Okay, there's a lot of things that we don't know that are going on behind the scene. So just because two products might raise the ketones the same number,
help me understand.
We don't really fully know, but there's, with the hard ketones, the focus of that product is single-handed to get people off of regular alcohol, ethanol. Like, I don't know what your position is, but some studies say, one drink a night might be actually beneficial. But some of those studies, when you actually peel it away, they found that the reason that the one drink a night people lived longer was because the people that were zero drinks a night, a large portion of them were people that were diseased, just got diagnosed with cancer, and they were told that they have to stop drinking alcohol. Yeah. So then they go to zero, and then they die off earlier, and then it screws up all of the data, because the zero drinkers are, people that were drinking zero because of a disease. So I'm in the camp that even one drink a week isn't healthy. I don't know where you are on that.
No, I agree. I'm not a big fan of alcohol. I rarely drink it.
Right.
But on the other hand, if someone found great social value in drinking small amounts on a regular basis, I don't know that that's going to be significantly
harmful. Sure.
Well, it might be. There's a lot of variables that we don't know, but there's some studies that support that as a lifestyle.
But if someone's going to a wellness center and they're drinking, one or two drinks a night, I would say all of these different biohacking things you might try, the number one thing is going to be to get that person off of that one or two drinks a night to see the best benefit inflammation.
No, the number one thing is to get them off of seed oils.
Okay. Sure.
That's going to increase reductive stress, which will secondarily massively increase oxidative stress.
Okay.
And the reductive stress, when you've got an excess of NADH running around, you are moving the body in the wrong direction. Rapidly.
Well, I think the seed oil there's probably less of an addiction to seed oil. Maybe there is an addiction, so you can cut that out more easily. Alcohol is a little bit.
It's actually a challenge. It's not a reward challenge.
Right. You have to look at what's in your ingredients, and it might be much harder to eat out and stuff like that. But it's not an addictive craving like regular alcohol, just visceral chemical imbalance. So people have been able to switch from regular ethanol to our product, either cold turkey, or they cut their alcohol in half by drinking some of our stuff first.
Okay.
And it helps with alcohol withdrawal symptoms and just helping get people off of regular ethanol. We've had some people now a year and a half that haven't drank anything. They were drinking a bottle of wine a night, switched over to two cans of our stuff, and haven't gone back. And it's been, and then they got off of our stuff. That's the important thing. Two months later, I said, "Hey, you haven't ordered. Are you okay?" She's like, "Oh, I'm fine. I'm just not ordering anymore." I'm like, "Well, did you go back to wine?" She's like, "No, just went to water. I'm sorry." I'm like, "That's not a bad thing. That's a great thing. Like, you transitioned to our stuff, and then you just were able to just stop our stuff." And even the weird thing about this drink is, because of the ghrelin effect, it lowers your desire for itself. So normally with a beer, you have the blood glucose spike, and I think is it acetate that goes into the brain, you just desire another beer and another beer and another beer. But with this, people have one or two and they just don't crave a third, fourth, fifth.
I think it might be acetaldehyde, isn't it?
Well, the ethanol converts into acetaldehyde, but then acetaldehyde then converts to acetate, which I think goes into the brain. The brain craves the brain craves that as part of that cycle of ethanol. And then the R13-butane diol converts to a 4-carbon version of acetaldehyde that is not as bioavailable, so the body can't use it as a toxin, and then it goes on to quickly convert to beta-hydroxybutyrate ketones. So
I think that's an important part of this conversation, is that for any one of you who struggle with alcohol for whatever reason and are concerned about it, that, I mean, you've got to be foolish not to consider this product to help you or someone you love who is in a similar scenario, because it clearly it works. Nothing works 100%, but it's certainly worth a try.
And as far as, you know, people care about three things: taste, price, and buzz.
Yeah.
And what we found with the buzz is people that are already using SSRIs or Kratom, mm-hmm. they don't feel a buzz at all, no matter how many they drink. And we don't know, I don't know exactly why. We just, you know, 80% of our customers feel the buzz with one or two, and those that don't, we refund them. But I ask them a series of questions, and time again, oh yeah, I do take SSRIs. Does that matter? Just when you keep on saying that, you know, repeatedly, we now put it on the can, you know, you won't feel anything if you.
You know why that is?
The GABA receptors get, I don't know if the word is blown out or
blunted. Yeah, and serotonin is not a health molecule. It really isn't. In excess, it will destroy health. It's like a serotonin, an estrogen agonist, actually. And you do not, SSRIs are very dangerous. They should not be on the market at all. They're really dangerous drugs. They should not be used by anyone.
Yeah,
I know it's a strong statement, but I believe that. Really bad idea. So, you know, in the future, you know, I'll send you some articles on this that show the dangers of serotonin, and you may be serving them, you know, I know they're not your customer at that point, but just helping them out, doing the right thing, and let them know that it may be time to consider a course of weaning off this. And if they really believe they need an antidepressant, there are other options.
I would send them that link for sure. Cause you know, trying to get people off of medicine in general.
Your test is a marker to identify these individuals, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Kratom's another issue. I'm not a huge fan of Kratom. It helps something, but it has a questionable legal status too.
The questionable legal status, and people email me saying, I wish I'd listened to your podcast telling people to stay away from Kratom because it's highly addictive. He's like, I'm now up to 8 bottles a day and I feel like I'm addicted. And the Kratom stuff, I'm not a fan of that.
Yeah. I actually grew some Kratom trees because I live in a subtropical area, and one of the hurricanes took them all out.
maybe that was
they were like 30 feet.
That was a sign. So when you take the hard ketones, do you feel a buzz or a sense of relaxation?
No, there's definitely a buzz. I don't take SSRIs.
Right.
And you know, it's actually a treat because your pina colada flavor is just like, oh, I mean, I don't drink pina coladas, but I did in the past just because of the flavor. It's so sweet and tasty. And
we try to make it, it's probably sweet for you, but we actually try to make it as low on the sweetness scale as possible.
No,
so palate.
I'm a big fan of sweet.
Well, the general population wants it sweeter. So we've tried to make it as unsweet and subtle as possible. We have two other stronger drinks I think you've tried, probably the GNT and the ginger mule, but those are less water in them. So they've got more of a kick to it, and people have to get used to it. And I think what we just sent you is our newest can called Doctor Up. So Doctor Up is designed for you to doctor up your own drink. So it's unsweetened and no added flavor, which I thought you might like too.
Okay.
And you just make your own. We didn't want to sell a concentrate because someone's going to go and do a TikTok challenge and mess it up. So we still wanted to have an 8-ounce can to have you, you know, drink 8 ounces. But this is designed for you to make your own stuff. So people are using their either sugar-free or with sugar cocktail mixers and making their own drinks.
You know what else you can do? Yeah. There's this new device, relatively new. It's been out for a while, but maybe a year. It's called the Ninja Creamy. Have you heard of that?
No.
It's Ninja's a really good company with respect to making devices in the kitchen. Like, they got a great mixer and blender. But this Creamy, you freeze up a drink. You put in, although I don't know, well, there's no alcohol there. You couldn't freeze alcohol. Obviously, it doesn't freeze. But this drink you could, because there's no alcohol in it. But I
this drink, the R13, it does freeze at this concentration. We have had them explode in the freezer.
Okay, good. So then it would work. So you can take that and you can create your choice and you can have an alcohol-free ice cream.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could. You could do it.
Yeah, or just make your pina colada even more, more like a frozen pina colada. Yeah. Frozen daiquiri. Yeah.
Yeah, this the creamy device, it really works. It turns it into almost like commercial ice cream.
I've seen the Ninja
blenders
and stuff, but the creamy is
starting to take off. It's really
now cool. With the hard ketones, do you take them for any other benefit at night, triggering GABA? And what are your thoughts on?
No, I like natural progesterone. I think it's better GABA agonist.
Okay.
It's really, really effective. And it's a really powerful estrogen antagonist. And cortisol, it's a cortisol blocker. I think natural progesterone should be taken by just about everyone.
Well, you mentioned cortisol blocking. So one non-scientific thing that we found with people that take ketone ester before bed is that they don't get that 2 a.m. cortisol spike that wakes them up and then sometimes keeps them up for 2 hours. They take a half of a capful, like $1 worth, and they're like, hey, I just didn't wake up at 2 and woke up and my cell phone was still on my chest, which I'm sure you don't agree with, but they didn't. The whole point is that they didn't roll around. That they didn't roll around is the point
of that. Okay, if it's in airplane mode, but most of these people, it's not.
Right. Yeah.
So they're just radiating themselves. If they had knew the damage, the problem is it's so convenient and it's so unnoticeable. There are no acute symptoms. You just find out 10 or 20 years later when you got cancer.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you think ketone ester could be a basis, help with the radiation from the cell phones?
I think so. Yeah. BSIS work suggests that pretty strongly at the NADPH, right? Yeah, that activates. I think that's the mechanism.
We have had some pilots. I actually just got an order that said, from a hotel in Miami, and it said like Air France pilots that were ordering it. And
smart pilots.
Prep my
newsletter.
Maybe. And then the first ketogenic astronaut went into space last month. He was ketogenic. He was given a meal plan of 700 items, and he picked the most ketogenic items on the list. They wouldn't give him more, oils and stuff like that. They NASA just wasn't that advanced. They're still kind of stuck in the 70s and 80s when it comes to nutrition. But he takes our product before the launch, and then I wish he could take it up with him. But he was, keto while up there. I'd love to see if there's any data on his blood.
I think the correct choice would have been to love me if you could take your product up there. I think that would have been helpful. I'm not convinced, as I said earlier, that the ketogenic diet is a good strategy. Because you mentioned taking your product to block cortisol, but one of the reasons cortisol would be secreted at 2 in the morning is that your glucose levels are so low, and you potentially be, if you're on a low carb diet, there's a real, if you're taking 50 grams, like 100 grams of glucose or carbohydrates a day, your glycogen stores over time will become depleted, and you will run out of glycogen in the middle of the night, and you'll have to secrete cortisol to activate the creation of glucose. So you don't want to block that response because it's therapeutic. It's actually life-saving.
Well, no, this was for non-keto people. I actually don't tell people that are already keto, I tell them not to take my drink before bed because it's too cumulative. It's too cumulative. It's too much. But non-keto people, they can, when my wife goes in and out of keto, she forgets, and then she takes the same amount of ester before bed, and it drastically changes her sleep. And she's like, I was cleaning the closet for 2 hours.
For the worse.
For the worse, yeah. Taking ester while keto was too much, yeah.
Yeah, you will not sleep well. You'll be too activated.
Yeah.
You're just amped up because your cortisol is really high, and that's not good. You just, not a good strategy. And so I'm glad you're doing that, because that is really a wise course, because it doesn't help your sales. It hurts your sales, but you're telling people the truth and letting them know that this is dangerous to take when you're on keto. Do not take it.
Well, I don't know about dangerous. It just made your sleep worse. I mean, it just.
That's a sign. I mean, I'm not saying it's going to kill you prematurely, although it might, if we're long term, over years and years. But it's certainly not pushing you in a healthy direction. Put it that way.
Yeah, but the people that are non-keto taking it before bed, they're recording 30 minutes more deep sleep.
If they have adequate glucose stores and plenty of glycogen, then I think it's a good strategy. And I told you, that's what I do.
Yeah.
Or did. I kind of stopped it for a while, but I'm kind of re-inspired by talking to you. So I think that's...
Yeah, people with their Oura Ring data, they're able to see real time. And then also, let's talk about HRV. That's when people see a big difference is in the recovery of the ketones. We haven't even talked about the ketones with response with regard to recovery. So we sponsor the number one cycling team in the world, Quick Step. I go to the Tour de France, and these teams use huge amounts after their 7 hours of riding and a huge amount before bed, like crazy amounts that I would never recommend. They drink an entire bottle after the ride and before bed.
Is that 50 grams in a bottle?
No, so 25 grams of active is what they take after the ride and 25 before bed. And I tell the regular consumer, unless you have 7 hours of, you know, 500 watts an hour, do not do this. And I'm actually wondering whether they're taking so much that somehow it's creating an energy excess that's then creating this a crash on the other end that's making them fall asleep, because it's mind-boggling the amount that that they're taking. But the number one study I would want to touch upon for recovery is they simulated a Tour de France race, and they gave these large amounts after a 15-day race. They simulated 4 to 6 hours a day of racing, these large amounts. And the ketone ester group was able to do 15% more watts during these 15 days. And then the final time trial was 15% faster. So it was over placebo group, it was a monumental difference in recovery.
Has it become a recognized physiological fact within that community, so much so that almost everyone is using it, because without they're at a disadvantage?
Yeah. I looked at the roster last year, and I was able to find 90% of the teams had at least one customer, and they often buy, you know, one guy will buy it to give it to the team. And we had supplied 90% of the teams. It's the de facto, but no one here in the US, very few people in the US know about it. And it does work beyond cycling. So cycling is now the default. And one guy was actually saying within Quick Step, he was making a comment about how tired he was, but it was his first Tour de France, and the other guys that were older laughed and said, "You haven't done a Tour de France without ketone esters." It's like a night and day difference. So it was horrible for him, but it is just another level of more horrible. And the times have just been, over the last 4 or 5 years, have just been sustaining the watts over the days like they've never seen. So I wish I haven't seen a chart, but if there was a chart, you'd probably see the watts averaging, you know, over the years. And the way that they're just not dropping off and slowing their watts over time has been, drastic. But in the U.S., we have, Duke University, the men's basketball team, took it during the ACC tournament. And that's a recovery thing. And they took low doses, too. That was a huge difference. They took only 10 mLs instead of 50 mLs right after their game. And they were able to track their glycogen restoration in their muscles is what they looked at. And just helping you recover and be, more sharp the next day. And also people that do two workouts a day, they take it after the first workout and they feel the second workout, they say, "It felt like I didn't even work out, in the morning."
So that's a pretty powerful anecdotal story. I mean, I think it's useful to look at the results of highly competitive athletes. Now, I am not a fan of the extreme cardiovascular endurance like Tour de France. I mean, it's a real testimony.
Healthy. Tour de France is not healthy.
Very unhealthy, and they're damaging their health for doing it. But it is an extraordinary platform to demonstrate the power of these strategies.
And some ask whether ketone esters is healthy in the long term. And I like to say the cycling for 6 hours a day is not healthy. This is countering that.
Yeah, it's mitigating the damage for sure. Yeah. So it is healthy in that context. But I think it can be healthy. And I think, Veach made a good observation, is probably accurate, that some amount, especially if you're not in ketosis already from a low-carb diet, could be really an interesting consideration. Now, a point I wanted to mention, you said these cyclists were taking 100 grams, no, 50 grams a day. Twice a day,
50 grams of active, so 25 grams of active, so 50 mLs of the bottle, twice a day.
And the active is about $1 a gram, right?
Yeah.
So that's $50 a day. So it would be financially burdensome for many to do that. But it's unnecessary. It's absolutely unnecessary. The typical, what is your dose for the active for most people? Is it 2 grams, 5 grams?
No, talk in terms of the drink itself. So 10 mLs, so two capfuls, so two quote unquote servings, two capfuls of KE4. That's what the Duke basketball players used. And they were able to find benefit with $5 worth.
Oh, that's 5 grams then.
Yeah, 5 grams of active. Now, I did debate a little bit with the guy who did the clinical trial on, you know, 25 grams twice a day. And he's like, why are you telling people to take less, that it works just as well? And I said, I didn't say that. I said, we don't know whether less is as effective because no one has done a dose, you know, dose response and taking it down. I'm just saying people are finding benefit at $5 worth. Now, whether if money's no object and you already, you're not going to mess up your race if you're taking it after the race, sure, go ahead, take more. You can take as much as you can afford, and you can then decide whether you've noticed a difference between $5 worth and $25 worth. But most people find benefit in as little as, you know, $5 worth. Some people even less, but I like to stick with the 10 mLs post-workout. You'll see it in your HRV and recovery data.
What's the lowest dose that you've seen or noticed?
So when we first were selling the drink, it was literally the entire bottle, $30 was what you were supposed to take as one serving. And then we have a Facebook group, 3,000 people commenting saying, Frank, I'm telling you, I took half a bottle and it was, you know, even better. I'm like, okay. And then it just went lower and lower and lower. And before you knew it, one capful was what I like to say, a lightweight female, the minimum dose that a lightweight female will notice it. So one serving, one capful. But we have had instances, which I am reluctant to say, but you asked the question, where they used a 1 mL dropper and they took 1 mL of our drink. So half a gram of ketone ester. I don't know. They swear by it. They take a small, tiny amount and they swear that it does something. And I'd love to prove it. But that's.
Yeah. So it's something to consider. It's definitely, you know, as I said, I'm not a fan of nutritional ketosis at all. I mean, there may be clinical cases that's therapeutically useful and even optimal. Not many though, from my perspective.
I've been reluctant to say this, but I have been keto myself for about 6 years now, all the way straight through. And for me, I love it. When I'm not keto, I can't read my kids' books to sleep. That's my main difference. At 7 p.m., I'm like,
You have to make a transition for sure. I mean, you just don't go keto and stop. You have to change. I'm glad to talk to you offline on how you might, if you want to consider that. I'm not suggesting you're unhealthy. I just think biologically it's not optimal from my review.
I'm at a low level of ketosis, you know, 0.5, 0.8 in the morning, just a steady state. And, you know, I've gotten all the blood work and the doctors are using and gut work. And
it's the issue is the chronic cortisol activation that you have to, which is difficult to assess, but through blood work. I mean, you can, but you need some sophisticated testing to do that. So, you know, that's the only concern, the primary concern, because you just don't want to hit the brakes that much or the emergency switch when you don't have to. But anyway, you've provided a great product. I really thank you for doing that and for, you know, advancing the science on this. But maybe before we leave, your website, give us your website, but there are other ketone ester-like products. There's one primary one. I don't even remember what it is, but what about your competitors? How would you compare them?
Right. So there's two other ketone esters. One is the C8 bonded to the R13-butanediol. Mm-hmm. And that one, maybe with food, might have some benefit, but it is not nearly as bioavailable and actually more expensive, even though it might look cheap at $5, you know, per 25 grams. It's just, I've never had one customer switch to that and stay. It just never happened. I have had customers switch and said, hey, I read the bottle of yours and I read the bottle of theirs and, you know, the ingredients look the same. Explain to me, you know, why did I not feel the same thing? And I actually made a podcast out of it. I got them on video saying, you know, and we went through it and said, you know, the ester bond is important. Some companies will just pour the two ingredients together and just say, hey, good enough. Well, Veatch would have done that 20 years ago. But then, you know, the main competitor is actually, you opened up the can of worms, but the main competitor is selling R13-butanediol and confusing people to think, or many people think that it's a ketone ester. Mm-hmm. It's not a ketone ester. It's R13-butanediol. So the same drink that we say gives you a buzz, and you said that you felt a buzz, they're selling as a brain nootropic sports drink to go drink and get on a, take three servings and get on a bicycle and go 60 miles per hour down a Tour de France, you know, hill. I think buzzed. And I think that's dangerous. We actually put it on our cans, not for sport. So that company, they raised $6 million to study ketone ester. But then in their marketing, they say, look, we got $6 million from the government to study exogenous ketones. And they had the ketone ester 4 years ago, but they lost their license. Mm-hmm. So when they lost the license, they're like, you know, scrambling around all this venture capital money. What am I going to do? They came up with the R13-butane dial and said, oh, we'll just pitch this as a ketone ester replacement. Meanwhile, I'm saying to get a buzz with it, they're saying to use it as a workout drink. And it's just confusing people. And so those DARPA funding, you know, those are only doing ketone ester. They've not converted over to studying, you know, R13.
And the license was from Veatch?
Veatch's, you know, UK partners. We mentioned before about the UK gold medals. Okay. It's funny. In the NIH, they were manufacturing ketone ester that was being shipped to the UK to help the UK win gold medals, while the US probably just didn't believe it or didn't understand it.
Wasn't aware of it or didn't
understand it. Or there's just so much noise out there that, you know, what are you going to,
Okay. All right. Well, give us your site where if people want
to. So for the ketone ester side, it's Ketone Aid, KetoneAid, Ketone Aid. And then the hard ketones is hardketones.com.
Okay. Pretty simple.
Yeah.
Straightforward.
And soon we'll have I've been saying this for a while, but we're hoping to have a beer. A beer is our breakthrough product, that low carb beer. Well, now you're saying maybe not even make it low carb. But
I don't think there's a value to it. Now you want to be careful, you know, and but for some reason you believe it or notice a difference, fine. But just, you have to be careful for chronic cortisol activation.
Well, they can get their carbs from somewhere else. They can add it to their drink if they'd like. But we're trying to stay still in the consistently in the low carb.
Yeah, there's definitely a market. I think it's a wise business decision because there's still a lot of people that believe that. So I think it's good for the business for sure. Okay, right. Well, Frank, any other questions or not questions, comments you have before you leave?
I think we covered anything. I think one thing that people, the takeaway is that this isn't something that's, we don't even call it a supplement. We call it a food. And supplements people have to take for 10, 30 days to maybe feel something. This is something that you feel immediately, one or two days.
And as a food, you've shown or experienced, that people experience, that it could be a resource to wean themselves off of an alcohol addiction.
Yeah, for the hard ketone side. Yep. Even though a paper actually just came out talking about the ketone ester for weaning off of alcohol, I think they have the wrong molecule. So they were able to find some benefit with the ketone ester, but the hard ketones is exponentially better for that. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for all you do. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Bye now.